There's a tension that's been on my mind a lot lately, between the private and public sphere. The tension of what I should and should not share with the world. Some of the people I most admire have put themselves out there. They've lived in public. I learned a ton from their stories, and sometimes just felt less alone in my own struggles. I've made some of my closest friends this way, whether through sympathizing with their struggles, or even just from seeing someone else's thought process and thinking, oh, you're like me, let's be friends. But there are some real drawbacks putting yourself out there too much. You become beholden to an audience that has expectations from you. They may judge you without knowing you. They may take what you said out of context and spread a false narrative about you. When should you and shouldn't you put yourself out there? What's the right balance between, on the one hand, learning and growing in public and getting feedback, and on the other, ensuring that you alone are the judge of your success, not the public? And also protecting privacy of people you care about. What trade-offs do you have to make when putting yourself out there? No one has put themselves out there more than James Altucher. Over the last few years, James has blogged about relationships, his business failures, the highs, lows, and everything in between. He talks about how to say no, how to avoid crappy people, and with his radical honesty, has really tapped into something that has millions of people reading his thoughts. What's the right balance between private and public? I don't really know, but James is a fascinating case study. All right, here's James. So I'm here with James Altucher in Manhattan, and I'm super excited. I've been reading your stuff for a while. Yesterday, I tweeted and I Facebooked, what are some questions for James Altucher?
Did people respond?
Yeah, people gave questions? Great questions. We had a couple fans on the team. So, I'm really excited. I mean, there's a lot we can get into from startups to investing to relationships to advice to education to how to deal with crappy people to holidays to how to say no. But I thought I'd just start and, we'll get into all these things with what are you most thinking about right now? What's most exciting in your life? What are you most grappling with? What's most on your mind right now?
I always try to figure out how to improve in three ways. So I always try to figure out how can I deliver more value to the readers of my writing. So I'm always trying to improve as a writer. I'm always trying to improve as an investor because I've been a horrible investor in the past and now I'm trying to deliver more value to the companies I'm invested in. And I'm always trying to grapple with issues of what do I really want out of life? For instance, why do I want to be a better writer? Is it because I have ego and I want a lot of people to read my stuff? Or do I want to, I hope it's because I want to sincerely help people. But, there's to do any kind of writing or podcasting or anything, there's got to be some ego involved. And I try to deal with my own personal issues around that. And I think also related to that is there's always an underlying fear of failure. So if I'm not, and this is just being honest, like if I don't feel relevant, have I failed? Am I dead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So part of being an investor and part of being a writer is feeling relevant, to the people you're writing to and the people you're investing in and the value they provide to their customers. And so I want to, I guess, and again, there's ego involved, like, why do I want to feel relevant? Why do I feel dead if I don't feel relevant? Right. So there's kind of a, I almost want to say like a meditation aspect to that, although I don't like using that word. There's this almost not quite a spiritual aspect to that either.
Like a Zen?
Yeah, sort of like what's the real goal of life? Like, is it to feel relevant to your peers or is it to somehow get over that fear of feeling irrelevant?
And what do you think the answer is for you?
I think the answer is to get over the fear of, feeling irrelevant, but that's very hard. So people often try to obtain things in life, whether it's some sort of financial goal, some sort of spiritual goal, some sort of, goal of happiness. But I think it's better to have no goals. Mm-hmm. When you have no expectations, it's easier to exceed them. And then I wonder if that's a better way to kind of achieve not necessarily happiness, but kind of a calmness in life that, overrides everything else.
Right. You have, as I've known from writings and just hearing you speak, and I can relate to this, kind of an obsessive personality. You mentioned perhaps an addictive personality.
is working super hard in these things kind of a default? And how are you, when you're saying, you know, the goal is to have no goals in some ways, are there ways you're trying to turn off? How do you kind of thinking about, you know, this idea of one, have you made it? Do you feel like you've made it? And two, how are you trying to achieve that future goal of having no goals?
Well, okay, so have I made it? I don't. I would say whenever I have felt that way in the past, mm-hmm. I've almost immediately lost everything. Right. So I think that's part of the reason why I'm just in constant fear of even feeling that way. Mm-hmm. So I would say no to that. And then in terms of, you know, every day I try to feel grateful for what I have, because I think feeling anxious about what I don't have can't be in the same head as feeling grateful for what I do have. So practicing gratitude every day is very important. And it's an easy thing you could practice all day long, as opposed to like people who meditate 15 minutes a day and then they feel anxious for the rest of the day. I try to intermix gratitude with almost everything I do. But, you know, it's really hard. Like, every day I try to think of other ways almost to trick my mind into not having goals, but it's a difficult thing because it's, as humans, it's almost natural to be goal driven. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, I imagine I pick some almost obscenely high number, like what will the universe be like 800 trillion years from now? Like, the universe is only 15 billion years old. So what will it be 10,000 trillion years from now? Mm-hmm. And clearly we're irrelevant. Everything we do, everything we think is irrelevant if you think in that perspective. So I practice thinking of things like that every day. I don't know if that helps or not, but at least during those moments, it reduces kind of the anxiety of relevance, you know, a little bit.
And it's interesting. I've noticed from your blog, you're very conscious of habits. And I think at one point, did you make an app about kind of trying to fuse the habits of, you know, emotional health, you know, spiritual health, intellectual health? To what extent do you think that technology can help improve our kind of habits and the way we, you know, prioritize things?
I don't think technology can help that much. I mean, I think it could move the needle a little bit, but I think you have to really understand fundamentally that, you know, let's take health. Most mm-hmm. people assume that means physical health.
Right.
But, you know, it's also connected. Like, you know, in our stomach, we have almost more neurochemicals than we have in our brain. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you're stressed, your stomach's going to feel bad. Like, there's so much connection between anxiety and stress and fear and love and all these other things, and how you feel in your stomach and your chest and heart attacks and strokes and Alzheimer's and cancer. Like, there's all these documented links between these things. So it's very important to not just go to the, you know, so many people drive to the gym and then go on the treadmill. So there's so much more to physical health than just exercising. You also have to be emotionally healthy and, you know, be around people you love and respect. You have to be mentally healthy. You have to be creative. You have to be spiritually healthy in some way. And again, I don't like the word spiritual because that means mm-hmm. different things to different people, but you can replace that with gratitude or whatever. But they're all connected. And so I like to develop habits. Even though they're all connected, I like to separate out physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual health and make sure I'm kind of making progress each day in each of those levels. So as opposed to saying, okay, I'm physically healthy, I don't know if I am or not, mm-hmm. but I like to at least make progress in that and all the other levels every single day.
That's interesting. I ask because we see a lot of products on Product Hunt that are like technology to try to get away from technology, like apps that help you, you know, not use your phone or not use your computer.
Do you know Manish Sethi, for instance?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just interviewed him for one of my podcasts, Ask Altucher. He's got this product, Pavlok, where it's about to be released, where it shocks you if you don't go, if you like break one of your good habits. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. Like, it will perhaps move the needle, and there's some scientific evidence that will move the needle. But you have to, the first step is you have to kind of want to, remove a bad habit. And, I think that there's a long journey to wanting to remove a bad habit. Many people don't want to remove their bad habits.
Right.
So.
No, it's interesting. So this podcast is a very personal one to me. So first off, you know, podcasts are often just excuses for me to get life advice from people, you know, I respect.
I do that too.
Yeah.
Like, it's good to, I had a podcast the other day where I was talking to two people about how they kind of deal with their issues of marriage and things like that. So it was great for me to use them as a therapist in the podcast.
Yeah, that's really awesome. That's really interesting. And especially, you know, this one, because I'm very interested, you know, and I write, I start businesses, I'm interested in investing, and as is a lot of our audience. One thing I'm also very intrigued by is how you're so honest and vulnerable, and you have been for a while, in your writing, and how that has benefited you a lot. What was that turning point for you where you started to become really honest? And I know you had a lot of, you know, people vilifying you in the beginning.
I always wanted to write. So I started writing, like, I wanted to write a novel like 20 years ago, or more than that, 25 years ago. So I started writing every single day, but I was writing horrible stuff. Like no fiction I ever wrote got published. But this was 25 years ago was when I was writing this. And then I started writing about more financial stuff, like about stocks and the economy in the 2000s. But it just got so stupid. Like, you'd write, all these people writing about the economy were so wrong and so just dumb. I just hated all of my peers, really. And not hate's a strong word. I didn't hate them, like I was friends with them, but I just hated the writing. Like, so many people were just lying all the time. I couldn't stand it.
Right.
And then people would just, like, you know, I'd go on CNBC with all these other, like, talking heads, and everybody was just so insulting and so stupid. And finally, I just got tired of it, and I just started saying, you know what, I'm going to get back to what I really love, which is kind of literary style writing, but I'm going to write about things I strongly believe in. I'm going to write about my own failure. Like, everybody in the financial world would always write about how perfect they were. And so I wanted to write something really honest about how, you know, look, life is mostly about failure and experimentation, and then there's brief moments of success in between, but that's okay. You want to experience all these highs and lows. So I started using my own life as an example, because you see, you know, I'll go on one of these websites and you see, oh, 10 ways to improve your interviewing skills. And then some guy or woman will be writing from a pedestal, do this, 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 and this. Well, I want to hear, they only know this because they have stories. Either they're lying because they have no experience, or they have some personal stories where they failed at interviews for many years and then learned how to be a successful interviewer or whatever, or mm-hmm. successfully give an interview. So I want to hear I think everybody can stand to improve their writing by throwing personal stories in. So what I did was I basically jumped into the deep end of the pool telling extremely personal stories, and then possibly sometimes extracting value out of that, like having a lesson at the end, or sometimes not. I just wanted to be entertaining. And so, you know, around 2009, 2010 is when I started doing that. And a lot of my ex-colleagues from the financial world thought I was completely insane. Like, why is he doing this? I didn't care. So I just kept doing what I was doing, and that built up a whole different universe for me.
It's interesting for a few reasons. One, because it seems that it just becomes more and more rare to see that, except, you know, in Silicon Valley and in tech world, a lot of my friends feel that they're consistently either being watched or have to be very careful of what they say, and it might be taken out of context. We were friends with the Rap Genius founder who got, did you follow that story?
Yeah.
He got thrown out, you know, to himself, he was just being honest. And of course, there's a fine line between being honest and vulnerable and then being, you know, making a joke that could get taken out of context. But it's something I think about, one, on a grand scale of how honest can I be without hurting, you know, business opportunities, you know. Now I'm responsible to investors, you know, to you know, the founder, and also relationship-wise, you know, as you have asked Altucher, you do a lot of stuff with your wife. It's really amazing. A lot of people benefit from, you know, hearing other people talk about how to have better relationships and how they work through it. But, you know, my girlfriend at the time was very not okay with me talking about it in any sort of public. How do you think about those things? Or what do you advise someone?
Yeah, I never really say anything. I only say bad things about myself. So I never say, for instance, I have an ex-wife. I never write about her at all. I don't want to drag her into my own issues. Sometimes I'll write about my kids, but never anything like overly mm-hmm. embarrassing about them. But I will never hold that back anything about myself, because I figure, you know, so people write articles sometimes trashing me, but what can they say that's worse than I've said about myself already?
That's interesting.
And, you know, sometimes I'll write stuff about ex-partners, but I won't name them right. if I write something negative. You know, I'll just instead write about what I learned or why did I fall into this trap of having a bad ex-partner or whatever. So I think, you know, you can put you can still be extremely honest and authentic, but put boundaries around who, you know, who you're hurting.
Right.
So I make sure I'm the main person I'm hurting. But look, people close to me don't like how I've hurt myself, so I've lost relationships that way.
Right.
But then it's not my problem. It's their problem. You know, in terms of like take that Rap Genius story. I think also if you're being honest, you can't just randomly spew trash around at everybody else. I'm not saying he did or anything. I actually don't fully know what he said or anything. But I always try to deliver some sort of value at the end. So I try to be very entertaining and tell a personal story because I think that's what people will read and listen to. But I try to provide some value where people are benefiting rather than getting hurt. And so to some extent, that's why I think having spiritual health as well as other as well as being honest and authentic is important. Because I think as long as you're on that path, your honest and authenticity is going to come through in a positive way instead of a negative way.
Right. And one of the things your, you know, honest writing has gotten you is a very big audience of readers and a very engaged fan base. How do you think about that audience? You know, a lot of people, for example, we were just talking about Jonathan Franzen. He has a big audience as well, but he doesn't really, you know, he doesn't engage with them online. He's not online at all. And then on the other extreme, you know, there are people who talk to their, you know, audience every day and really get a lot of pleasure because they feel like they're talking to other, you know, variations of themselves, right? You know, people are very close, even though they're, you know, strangers in some capacity. How do you think about what's ideal in terms of you? What type of audience do you want to have? How often do you want to engage with them? How, you know, are there times where you just want to turn off? How do you think about
You know, it's a good question because a lot of times people will email and they'll email, you know, a lot of people are going through a lot of pain in their lives right now. Like since 2009, the world's turned upside down. Everyone's gotten fired. Everyone's had some sort of financial stress. Even if you're not in financial stress, you realize that the world we've been led to believe is safe is not necessarily safe. Like you might get, you know, fired from your job or entrepreneurship is harder than people thought. And so people write to me often and they're in a lot of pain and they want a response. And so I try to respond in my articles that are for many people as opposed to it's hard for me sometimes to respond one-on-one or if I'm doing like a podcast, sometimes right. Claudia and I respond. But I try to engage as much as possible with the audience because I think we're not living in a broadcast age. We're living in kind of a microcast age.
Right.
So I was just reading how the Beatles, when they first came to America, they went on the Ed Sullivan Show and 73 million people watched that show and then started buying the Beatles albums. And then that set off like, you know, Beatles were number one in the charts for the next 6 years. That will never happen again. Mm-hmm. Like that era where one guy, Ed Sullivan, can choose you and then you're suddenly going to be, you know, the Beatles, that's over. So now we live in this age where, you know, you kind of have to build relationship with an audience because these are the people who will, they're your broadcasters. They're the ones who are going to tell their friends and those friends. So everything's kind of a word of mouth world, which is not necessarily high tech, but technology has brought us there. Like, look at YouTube.
Right.
You know, you take, are you familiar with Miranda Sings?
No.
Okay, so you're not familiar with her, which is very interesting. Her videos have had over 500 million views. She's, Jerry Seinfeld just had her on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Mm-hmm. She's very funny. Mm-hmm. And and just, you know, millions and millions of fans. But they're her fans that have spread through word of mouth. You haven't seen her on, she's never been on David Letterman. Jerry Seinfeld went on David Letterman and said, have you heard of Miranda Sings? And David Letterman said, no. And Jerry Seinfeld was like, well, she's coming on my show. Now, he didn't choose her. He only saw her because she had already had 500 million views on her YouTube videos. So again, like we have technology that can help us, you know, microcast our experiences and our views, but ultimately it's good old fashioned word of mouth. We're back to a word of mouth age where, you know, that's how stories got transmitted for thousands of years. Yeah. And now we're back to that's how stories are going to get transmitted for the next 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Thanks to technology.
No. Yeah. That's really interesting. And on that note of big audience and ask, you know, Product Line has started to get, you know, a bit of an audience. And I've noticed that my life has changed in the past year, and that I'm talking to a much wider, you know, range of people. But, you know, beforehand, I would talk to maybe, you know, I'd send longer emails to 10 close friends, 10 individual close. Now I'm sending, you know, those same emails, but to a wide, much broader range of people. And some of those friends feel a little bit left out because they were used to kind of this individualized attention. How do you think about this, you know, just in terms of your own fulfillment, this idea of, you know, close friendships that are kind of one-to-one as opposed to this one-to-many? Both are fulfilling, but what's your ideal kind of balance between those?
You know, there's only so many people yeah. you could be friends with. But I've met a lot of friends through my writing now. Like, yeah. I would say my friendships have completely turned over almost 90% because since writing and being like authentic in my writing, that's attracted a good group of people to interact with me over the years, and I've made friends with them and so on. And I think someone asked me the other day, maybe it was Claudia actually, you know, what took me the longest in my life to understand? And I think what took me the longest in life to understand was that you really are the average of the five people yeah. you spend most of your time with. And you can't hide that. Like, you can't run away from that. Like, you're going to be like the people you've spent time with. And so I feel like I've sort of graduated from people that weren't necessarily such great people to, you know, a much better group of people that I like to be in the same room with or email with or communicate with and so on. And that's happened in every aspect of my life. And I think that's helped me a lot.
What's your advice if the five people you spend your most time with, I tell that to a lot of people and they're like, shit. Cause you know, maybe they don't like their roommate or even people in their, you know, immediate family. How do you think about, is it just kind of at all costs?
Yeah, because, you know, this is your life you're talking about. And so people sometimes wonder if this is selfish, like, oh, what if I have a friend who's in need? And are you going to say, just drop them if they're not a good friend? And the answer is no, don't just drop them, like be there for your friend. But you're not going to, you don't want to be codependent either. Like, you don't want to be involved in like every aspect of their lives. People need to help themselves as much as possible. So like, take a family member who's just permanently dragging you down, you know, or permanently angry at you or depressing you or whatever. Engage with them when necessary, but you have your own family and life to take care of. Like, you know, I don't know, you probably don't have any kids yet. No. Okay, I have kids, so I can't let, I've got to make sure my next generation of humans do okay. Right. So that's almost my biggest responsibility in life. And that, you know, that's my kids, but that's also my friends and the family that are going to listen to me or pay attention to me. I can't let anything affect my health, or else that'll affect negatively the health of the people around me. So that's how also word of mouth in a weird way. Right. So, you know, and earlier you asked, how does my writing about my problems affect my business relationships? And I didn't fully answer that, but I would say it's definitely cost me some business relationships. Like one time somebody read something I wrote and said, dude, how can anybody invest with you? You admit losing all this money. Well, everybody in the world has lost money at some point or other. It's just a lie if somebody says they've never lost money. So, but what's ended up happening is, okay, that guy is out. I'm not going to convince him. But people who respect the honesty and authenticity, I've actually had so many more opportunities now than I've ever had before, because people know I'm going to be, what they see is what they get. Like, I'm going to be honest with them, not only about myself, but about their businesses. So I'm not just trying to BS someone to get their business. I'm going to be honest with the people around me. So I've actually had more business opportunities than ever because I've been so honest about failures and things that I've been through and things that I've messed up and so on. Yeah. So at every level, you'll start to attract the right kind of people around you.
What I look to emulate about, you know, your career and what a lot of people I think admire is you have a platform on kind of a few different fronts. One, you know, you write about, you know, your life to an audience that appreciates it and that learns from it. You know, you share your thoughts, you create dialogue, you know, with your podcast with people you appreciate, respect, and admire. And then you also invest in the things you believe in. You can get involved in creative projects that you really have a comprehensive platform. Now, what would you tell your 23-year-old self who wants to write, who wants to build businesses, who wants to invest, who wants to have that platform? You might not do any things differently in retrospect, but if you were 23 right now, how would you kind of think about your career and life planning?
You know, I think something's very interesting that's happened lately. You know, people think about career in terms of money. Like if they have a better career, they're going to make more money. Right now, more than ever, it's important to not think about money. So it's important to think about ideas. Ideas, right? Nobody knows what's going to happen to money, whether there's going to be inflation or deflation or how much money do you really need. You know, there's no real answer to that. But everybody should be focusing on how can I generate more and more ideas to help other people. And the more you generate ideas to help other people and the more you come up with venues to express those ideas, the more money it's going to turn out you're going to make. The more opportunities you're going to have, the more abundance you'll create for others and then ultimately for yourself. So what I like to do is invest in people I know are going to have a ton of good ideas because they've just spent years or maybe decades building up what I call their idea muscle. Mm-hmm. So the idea muscle, ideas are like a muscle like anything else. Like if you don't exercise your legs for 2 weeks, you'll need physical therapy to walk again because the leg muscles have atrophied super quickly. The idea muscle is the same way.
Right.
If you don't exercise that idea muscle like every day, it's just going to atrophy and you'll run out of ideas. Like even in your own business, like every day, you guys should be thinking 10 more ways we can improve Product Hunt or 10 more ways we can get the word out about Product Hunt, 10 biz dev opportunities we could have about Product Hunt. I don't even know what you're doing. Like, are you socially connecting people? Like, oh, you guys have like the same product. Maybe you should meet or whatever. So there's so many. So ideas are really the currency of this century. It used to be you'd work for a corporation, you'd rise up, a corporation would take care of you, pay you more and more money, and then you'd retire. Now, that's not going to happen. Now, you need to, I think Peter Thiel expressed this really well on my podcast with him. Facebook got an offer for $1 billion, and Peter Thiel wanted Mark Zuckerberg to consider taking the $1 billion offer. He was a 22-year-old kid, and for Peter himself, it would have meant $135 million, and he had just invested, like a year earlier, $500,000. So it would have been a huge return. Would have been life-changing, even though he'd already had a lot of money. But Mark Zuckerberg was like, what am I going to do with $200 million? I'm just going to start another social network, and I like the social network I already have. And, here's an example where Mark Zuckerberg was wealthy in ideas.
Right.
So no amount of money could have exceeded the amount of wealth he had in ideas. So he just stuck with it. Now he's worth what? I don't know, like $20 billion. So, right. 100 times the amount he would have been worth. And I think things like that are important to learn from.
What ideas or what industry would you have, let's just say you're 23 practically, totally get that. Would you have, started working on startups, or what ideas would have excited you?
Well, it's really interesting right now because I think we're at a big inflection point where I was shopping for Christmas, for myself, because I buy myself stuff, and and my daughters the other day. And we went to Best Buy and we went to Verizon and we looked at all the phones and we looked at all the computers. And what we realize is that for the first time in maybe like 20 years, we didn't really want to upgrade anything. Like the newest computers or laptops or phones are not really better than last year's. So, I don't know what phone you have. What kind of phone do you have?
I'm about to get the iPhone 6, but I have an iPhone 4.
Okay, so you have an iPhone 4. So you're two generations away. But my older daughter has an iPhone 5. She doesn't really want to get the iPhone 6. Now, I do think the iPhone 6 Plus is a big improvement over the iPhone 5. But I have a Galaxy Samsung Note 3.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason for me to get a Note 4. Like, even the woman at Verizon said to me she couldn't figure out what the difference was between the Note 4 and the Note 3. And then I looked at the iPhone 6 Plus. It was actually probably worse than the Note 3. There was just no reason for me to upgrade. Now, okay, so I have a MacBook Air from 2 years ago. I looked at the latest MacBook Air, and I think I actually don't think they've had an upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like computers have sort of finished. Not that it's done. Like, Moore's law will continue to hold. Like, things will keep improving. But I don't really need for bandwidth to get much faster. I could download a movie in a few seconds already. I don't really need computers to get much faster because I'm just using Microsoft Word and a web browser. So I don't really need for phones to get much faster. What do I really need? I need the battery life to get better. Mm-hmm. So I need to be able to go 3 weeks on the same battery instead of one day on the same battery. But that's a chemistry problem. It's not a computer problem. So the last 50 years have been about computers. But I think for all before that, the problems that were being solved mostly were chemistry problems and material science problems. So it's like the 50 years ago, what did Dustin Hoffman get advised in The Graduate? Get into plastics. Well, you know, plastics is a material science and a chemistry problem. I think the next 50 years are going to be about chemistry again. And we're at a high point in people graduating with computer science degrees, and we're at a low point in people graduating with chemistry degrees. So I think those are the problems that are going to be solved next. How can we increase the battery life? How can I fold my little tablet here into pieces so I can put it in my pocket? You know, all these problems, again, are not computer problems. They're chemistry problems. So how can energy be cheaper and more efficient? Again, it's not a computer problem. It's a chemistry problem. So that's the areas where I'm investing now.
Interesting. And how would you explain your investment? You have investments over 30 companies, right?
Yes.
How would you explain your thesis?
You know, it changes because I was really into social networking, like let's say in 07 and 08. So I still have a lot of investments active from that from investments I made then, 07, 08, 09. And then more lately, I started investing more in biotech because I think as we get older as a species, you know, the average human is older now. We have 76 million baby boomers hitting the age of 65 and older. You know, biotech's going to be really important in how we, not so much new drugs, but how we, you know, prevention is the cure. So how we diagnose diseases is going to be really important. So I invest a lot in that. But now lately I find myself investing again, like I mentioned, in, you know, companies solving difficult chemistry related problems, because there's almost no R&D in the Fortune 500 in the chemistry space. So that's where I see there's opportunities.
Interesting.
You know, and there's deals. Yeah. So like, are you going to invest in Uber at a $40 billion valuation? Right. Or are you going to invest in some kind of forgotten area of science at a $500,000 valuation? So, you know, again, the problems are just as big. Like, I actually think Uber is a decent investment of $40 billion, but I still think, you know, companies at $1 million valuation that could hit $100 billion level are also decent investments.
And it's interesting, you know, Product Hunt, we see, you know, a few hundred companies a day, and everyone's trying to build kind of a, you know, a music app, you know, social network, you know, a lot of these consumer stuff, which are cool, but they're just saturated photo sharing. But there aren't as many people working on these really challenging and difficult.
Yeah, I see stuff all the time. Like, I just got something about I won't name the company, but it's about keeping track of people who have died, like all the memories and things about people who have died, like almost like a social network for dead people.
Yeah.
And my first thought was that Facebook already basically does this. And if families don't want to do this, they just pull down the pages of people who died. So again, there's nothing new. Like, in a split second, I could think of a way that Facebook already does this. So there's nothing hard. There's nothing new. You kind of want to go where problems are difficult to solve to find opportunity. Now, Uber actually solves an incredibly difficult problem that nobody has really realized yet. I'm sure the people at Uber have realized it, but most people who use Uber haven't realized it, which is that the economy itself is moving to an employee-less society. Mm-hmm. So every corporation is essentially firing all their employees. This is happening systematically, bit by bit. It's actually hard to see because they're outsourcing most employees immediately to temp agencies. And so you don't quite see the systemic change that's happening. But what does Uber do? Uber has three components. They have an entire workforce. Mm-hmm. And right now, the workforce is all drivers. But imagine they're a workforce willing to do anything. And then you have, on the other side, you have people who need things. So right now, it's people who need rides from one location to another, but it could be people who need toothpaste. It could be people who need a massage. It could be people who need legal help. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, there's logistics software that hook up these two massive groups of people. So I kind of think Uber is going to be sort of a slice of the economy rather than just a company. Yeah. You know, Uber and Uber-like companies are interesting. But then again, I think Uber is going to be is going to take the place of all the Uber-like companies that are starting to develop. Like, I see all these companies, oh, we're going to be the Uber of movies. We're going to be the Uber of hotels. Uber is going to be all of that. So, you know, just like Facebook became the social net, you know, there's no social network of left-handed people.
Right.
There's just groups of left-handed people on Facebook. So Facebook kind of became all of those social networks kind of rolled up. So again, that's why I don't, I kind of feel all the difficult hardware and software problems have been not necessarily solved, but that area is done as a huge opportunity.
Right.
And now there's people have to look at more difficult areas now.
Right. I know that as a, you know, in your early 20s, you've written about how you would write, you know, or read for hours a day and you would write often as well. How would you think about, you know, I'm sure there were times, you know, as if you were starting one of these companies, you have to be operating all the time. How would you think about the balance between, would you think about it in the way, I'm going to work really hard, you know, get a platform myself, then focus on my reading and writing? Or how did you think about it in your own life? And how would you, you know, redo it if you were 23 right now?
For 23 right now, the most important thing is having ideas every day, mm-hmm. and improving writing. And why is writing so important? Think about how we communicate now. We're all communicating through tweets and Facebook status updates and blogs and podcasts like this and sales presentations. It all boils down to the written word. Even this, you know, the podcast is not quite the written word, but you had to read everything, right. I was writing to do your research for this podcast and so on. So the written word is incredibly important, and you're seeing more writing than ever published. Like, you have platforms like, you know, LinkedIn, Medium, Huffington Post are publishing thousands of articles a day, you know, in addition to all the newspapers and media that we've, you know, been consuming for generations. So our consumption of media is enormous, and particularly the written word is enormous. And yet 99% of what's out there is being poorly written. And so I'm not pointing a finger like so-and-so is a bad writer. I just think people have forgotten the art of good writing. And good writing is not about, you know, what you're telling people. It's about what you're showing people. So, and you have to show people from the heart. Like, you have to tell a story, and people have forgotten how to tell stories. And so, and I think there's a lot to learn by reading, not just necessarily reading kind of the latest articles or the latest nonfiction, but really reading really high quality writers. Even if you're writing 10 tips to be a better interviewer, you have to read really high quality fiction, I would say, to really write a good nonfiction article. And so that's how I focus my reading and my writing.
And building off that, is there stuff that you write that you're proud of that you know an audience won't like? Or is there typically an overlap between what you like to write and what your audience likes to read, or what will do well?
No. In fact, the best thing I've ever written, I've never even really marketed it. And it doesn't really get a lot of sales. So I wrote a book called Choose Yourself, which was very popular, and I'm mm-hmm. very proud of it, and I think it's well written. But I wrote another book called The Choose Yourself Stories, which are my more personal stories, which have no, let's say, value whatsoever other than entertainment value. And I think that's like the most literary thing I've written, but hardly gets anybody buying it. Whereas Choose Yourself has had, which again, I'm really proud of, yeah. Choose Yourself, and I enjoy the writing in Choose Yourself, but it's more value driven as well as entertaining. And that has a lot more views or downloads or people buying it or whatever.
So you think you'd be doing these things together and, you know, starting a business and also building an audience via reading and writing?
Yeah, and this is the thing I grapple with every day. So should I focus on the business side? But I just enjoy writing. Yeah. So if I really was going to focus on delivering, you know, huge value to myself, I'd focus more on the business side. But I just love to write every day, and I love delivering value. And I mix up kind of my more entertaining stories with my more value-driven stories. Although all of the entertainment is the most important thing, because otherwise nobody will read anything.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is story-driven.
And it's interesting, you compare, you know, it seems that the skills that make you good at writing also make you good at business. Or is it different? Do you think about different ways?
It's hard to say because the skills that make me good at writing is the fact that I've practiced writing a lot and the fact that I read a lot.
And you're honest and
yeah. But I do think the audience is built because I'm trying to be healthy in these four ways I've labeled before. So the audience is built because they get a lot of value from the writing. So if I was just like trash talking people or writing about I don't know, the latest political agenda or whatever, I think that would be less interesting. You know, politics comes and goes, you know, but people are scared and people experience high degrees of stress, and that never goes away. That's always around forever. I don't know what the latest political issue is. It's just whatever the news media decides is going to be a big political issue. That's the story for the week. And people then argue their opinions, and then the opinions die off when the next news cycle happens. But people every day are scared about their relationships and about money and their jobs and careers and so on. So that's the stuff I tend to write about. And I think it's more evergreen that way, too. It lives forever. Like, you could read my stuff from 5 years ago. I will often republish stuff from 5 years ago because it has value now. So, I don't like to write about, Bush versus Obama, Iraq versus Iran, whatever. All that changes every year.
Do you have a content team or a couple people that help you kind of, organize or strategize what should be going on different channels or
no, is all nobody.
You?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I sit in front of a screen every morning and figure out, okay, I try to figure out what am I scared about today? So what bothered me yesterday? Cause that's what you're going to, it's like pulling something out of you and then throwing it on the page. Else it's going to be the generic, 10 ways to put a smile on your face today or whatever, all the kind of boring stuff that's out there.
When you think about what's made you successful, what do you think are your core competencies?
Somebody was telling me the other day that they thought I was a really good networker, and that surprised me because I've always been really shy and nervous about meeting people. But it turns out that I was thinking about it. I'm very good at thinking about all the different aspects of my life and introducing people from different aspects to each other and not being afraid that they might work together and I might get nothing out of it. Right. And so what ends up happening is a lot of people build their network as a big list. Oh, I know 100 people. I know 200 people now. I know 300 people now. But what really builds a network is not how many, it's not a spoken wheel approach. It's how strong the connections are between the different people in your network. So like for instance, yesterday I introduced a woman I know who's publishing a book to a guy I know who's very good at book marketing. Neither of them had heard of each other before, and she ended up hiring him to help her network her book. Now, I have nothing in the middle, I have nothing to do with her book, and I have nothing to do with his book marketing company. But the fact that they're working together in some microscopic way improves the value of my network. And I might not see the benefit of that ever, or I might see the benefit of that 10 years from now. And I have found, when I see the benefit 10 years from now, it's usually in a huge, huge way. Mm-hmm. So like a way involving millions of dollars. So you just never know how things turn out. But I'm always trying to figure out how I can permission network. Like if I wanted to introduce you to someone, I would say, hey, I know somebody good for you to meet. He does this, this, and this. And I'd get your permission. Then I would get his permission. And then I would introduce the two of you. So I find that to be very, and I try to do that every day. So what I call permission networking,
right?
And it works out very well.
So you're playing this long, it's a long, relationships and networking is a long game.
It's a long game because you never know, big opportunities in life and let's say ways in which you're going to make millions of dollars, that's only going to happen a few times in your life. But you have to plant a lot of seeds for that to happen. So you never know which seeds are going to grow. And this is even true of your gardening. I'm going to use a gardening example. I don't know anything about gardening. But what's the law? Pareto's law that says 20% of the seeds you plant will yield 80% of the trees that bloom or whatever. I don't even know what the terminology is. But it's the same thing. Like maybe 1% or 1/2 of or 1/10 of 1% of the seeds you plant in life will turn out to be of direct benefit to you. But again, it helps to always build that network that way by planting those seeds.
Yeah. What do these million-dollar opportunities look like? Is it, hey, there's this startup that's blowing up. Do you want to invest in it? Or is that one example? Or what are some of these, you know, huge outlier opportunities that have come to you look like?
I might start a business and let's say I start a business. There's two types of opportunities that could happen. Three types of opportunities. One is old connections might want to invest. Old connections might give me business development opportunities. Like, it's much better to cold call the head of business development at Yahoo if you personally know him from 10 years ago than if it's just a cold call. And somebody I know might want to buy my company. So that's like an entrepreneurial way. Another way is somebody might want me to be an advisor or a board member on their company in exchange for some equity. That equity might turn out to be very valuable someday. Another way might be somebody else is starting a company for whatever reason, the valuation is really low, or they want to give me a special deal, and I get those deals and invest, and then that could blow up. So that's really like the three ways I've made money. Or you know, somebody who likes my writing might want to say, hey, I have an email list of a million people. Can I sell your book and we'll split the profits right on my list of people? So I've made money, you know, that way too. Mm-hmm. You know, so choose yourself. I remember it was selling for 99 cents on Amazon and Kindle, but I put together a hardcover version for one email list, which wasn't available on Amazon, and I wrote some special premium products. Guy sold it on his list for $20. He sold, you know, 30,000 or 40,000 copies of it in a weekend. Wow. So you know, and he approached me because he had liked something I had written, you know, years earlier. Mm-hmm. So just luck.
So it's kind of a long game, and it's paying it forward and
yeah,
some capacity to people you believe in.
And that's why it's good to be around people you like and respect, because yeah, then it gives you more opportunity. I don't want to introduce people I don't like and respect
right
to other people I don't like and respect. Suddenly, when you're actually around like good quality people all the time, there's many more opportunities to introduce people. So all the people I introduce now, I like them all, and I know that they're good people to introduce to each other.
Yeah. Is that how you think about how you can add the biggest value as an investor? If you invest in an entrepreneur, you believe in them, you know they know what they're doing. How do you think about what's the biggest value you can add?
Biggest value I can add, there's really many layers of value. So for instance, one guy I'm invested in, he's very extremely good at what he does. He doesn't really have the biggest business sense. So he might think about, it's very hard to develop a good business sense. Like, there's a lot of people who have good products out there, but they don't necessarily know how to best utilize their time most efficiently, or the best partnerships to do, or how to take, you know, the most advantage of a partnership. There's lots of little details in making business decisions that people don't really understand. There's like a lot of subtleties in business, and people might understand big picture stuff like, oh, I built a product in a $1 billion business, but then there's like, okay, well, am I going to put this on the shelf of a store, or am I going to make a distribution deal with somebody, or am I going to get investments from somebody who can make a distribution deal with somebody? There's lots of little business decisions. You know, should I hire a new CEO to replace me because I'm the product guy? Like, there's a lot of little business decisions that I can help people make, because I've been involved in like now probably over 100 businesses, either as an investor or a founder or whatever, or an investor of an investor of. So there's that. And then in just terms of networking, connections, helping people raise money, I've raised hundreds of millions of dollars. I've helped people sell tons of companies.
Right.
So there's lots of ways, many layers I help people. But also there's the psychology of it. CEOs get stressed because they feel like they're going to be a failure all the time, and they're afraid of that. So there's kind of a sort of almost, I don't want to call it coaching because I don't like that word, but there's people need someone to talk to sometimes who have been through it before.
And going back to core competency, it seems that interpersonal skills and understanding kind of across the board, you know, helping you, you know, talk to a wide variety of different people and really understand, you know, different situations, and whether it's business or relationships, that's interesting.
Yeah, and if every day you focus on just trying to improve your health a little bit, you know, physically, like how can I just get eat a little better or sleep a little better or move a little more during the day? Or emotionally, how can I be around just a tiny bit more higher quality people during the day? Or mentally, practice your creativity every day. Or with gratitude, you know, how can I use gratitude to crowd out the anxiety I feel every day? Just doing a tiny bit, you know, 1% improvement a day compounds very quickly. So, right. And I have found from my own life, my life's changed like every 6 months incredibly. Like it's unbelievable each 6 months how it's changed from the 6 months before. So if I was 23 and I had started doing this, oh, I would have, I mean, I'm glad for all the mistakes I've made. Maybe I wouldn't have known what to do if I hadn't made those mistakes. But, you know, again, that's what the advice I would give my 23-year-old me. I wouldn't want to go back in time because I like exactly yeah. where I am. But if someone's 23 now, that's the advice I would give is just improve a tiny bit on these four areas every day.
I like that approach because a lot of people are very hard on themselves and they feel lost and, you know, and kind of distraught that they're not where they want to be, but and don't even know they get in their own way and don't even know where to start. And so this idea of 1% a day, you know.
Yeah, you see so many people, and I get these emails all the time. You see so many people say, oh, I'm 27 years old, and I feel like a failure. I don't know what I want to do with my life. And I have so many friends who, I mean, I have one friend. He's, I guess, about 85 now. He quit his job when he was 45 as like an insurance salesman, and he decided he was going to be a venture capitalist at the age of 45. Again, he's 85 now. And he became a venture capitalist like in, I don't know, whatever year it was. There was a recession happening, so he was totally bombing for years. And then like 4 or 5 years after that, he started a company which became Caremark, which was bought by CVS for billions. He made his first million around the age of 49. I don't know. He's worth like, obviously like a billion or so now. But again, there's so many examples like that. Careers change all the time. You know, I've probably had 10 different careers in my life. Like you can't ever punish yourself. You know, it's one thing if you did something bad, that's the first, I call that the first arrow. The first arrow could wound you, but then punishing yourself later, like, oh, I can't believe I did that. Like my life's ruined now. That's the second arrow. The second arrow will kill you.
Right.
So the first arrow, you can just pull out and move on. And, you know, you build the scab and then you have tougher skin and you move forward and you're actually better for it. But the second arrow could kill you. So, but it's really hard to avoid that second arrow. I understand, but it helps to remind yourself that, you know, so many people who are successful in life had second, third, fourth careers. I mean, Ray Kroc, who's maybe not a common name, but he was a milkshake salesman. He was 52 years old, came upon this clean store or restaurant that had like two or three franchises, and he bought it for something like $1 million. He borrowed the money. Maybe he bought it for cheaper than that. And, you know, then it became McDonald's. He became a multi-billionaire off of that. He was 52 years old.
I didn't realize he was that old when he...
Yeah.
Wow. Going to this mid-20s idea, how would you think about relationships? That's something personally I think, you know, I work so hard. You know, how do you just dating and just, you know, understanding who you want in a partner? How would you think about some of these things?
You know, it's hard because, like, you know, not everybody, like, friends, if you're an entrepreneur, you're like 24 hours a day thinking about your business. So you're gonna kind of... You know, what if your girlfriend is just doesn't want to talk about your business? You know, then that's a little bit hard to deal with because this is like obsessing on your mind. You know, I think the important thing to realize with relationships is that it's not a failure for a relationship to end. So I'm not saying everybody who doesn't talk about what you're interested in is but, you know, I'm divorced. I know many people who are divorced and then successfully remarried. I know people who've gone through many relationships. You know, just relationships are like anything else. Like they could be, you know, I had a very successful first marriage because I have two beautiful daughters out of that. So I'm happy with that. Now I'm successfully remarried and my wife helps me with every aspect of my business and I help her with her, you know, business ideas. So, you know, I just think, again, not punishing yourself for things. Sometimes things have a clock and the clock runs out. And you know, just again, always focusing on things that you want to be good for the other person and you want to be good for yourself. People live very long lives now.
Right.
So if you're, if you've been with someone, your high school sweetheart, since you were 15 and now you're 29, well, you might have another 50 years to go, you know, or 80 years to go.
Right.
So are you going to be with the same person all that time? Maybe, but maybe not. And you can't punish yourself for that.
Was it important to you as someone who's so interested in their crafts and what they're doing, and a lot of people who relate to this, to find a partner in that sense, you know, someone who shares those interests?
Yeah, I don't really like being alone. So a lot of people are fine, like, if not being in a relationship for years at a time. I like being in a relationship, but I wanted someone who was going to be, you know, understanding of what I wanted to do with both writing and business and career. And fortunately, I've found that, you know, if for whatever reason we go in different directions, then that happens. But I hope it doesn't. But you know, I'm glad that I found that for now.
What do you think about marriage as an institution? Do you think it's, you know, a lot of people are rallying against it, you know, in terms of, you know, people wanting to see multiple people, or just that we live very long lives and things change?
You know, I have friends who do both. Well, so there's two questions there, really. One is, should you be monogamous,
yeah,
even in a marriage? And then the other is, marriage is a legal institution. Well, I think marriage is primarily a financial contract. So you get married, it means that if you get divorced, then the government has a say in how you divide up your assets, unless you, again, made a financial contract before or after you got married. So I'm married, and I like being married because I think society has made us think there's an extra level of commitment somehow in being married. And I think that too, because society has programmed me that way. But I really don't think marriage should be a legal institution. And I do have to say, I do think people who, I'm pretty monogamous, and I do think people who are sleeping all over the place, I think they have two issues. One is, they're very busy all the time. So I remember one friend of mine, his wife was out of town, but they had an open relationship. And he said, you know, it's really hard for me because now my wife's out of town. I've got four or five other situations. I've got to make sure I spend time with each of them. And he couldn't. And this is like 4 years later. He still hasn't finished his latest book. He hasn't finished his latest business. You know, he's just been too busy, like, taking care of all these.
So the logistics involved.
Yeah, yeah, that's hard. And then the other thing is, he's also divorced now from his wife. So I also see that people, these relationships don't survive. Then again, I've been in closed relationships, and until the most recent one, none of them have survived yet either. So who knows? I'm not judging. It's just, I think it's very difficult to be in an open relationship, again, logistically. Yeah.
That's interesting. So would you tell your younger self, or if, you know, your mid-20s, to kind of explore, experiment, and, you know, think about, learn what you like and don't be too hard on yourself?
Yeah, yeah. Like, for instance, I've definitely stayed in relationships in my 20s that were maybe 1 or 2 years past the expiration date,
right,
or 4 years past the expiration date, or 9 years past the expiration date. So understand when the expiration date's been hit and move on, and don't judge yourself for it, and don't be afraid about hurting the other person, because you're gonna end up hurting them anyway,
right,
if it doesn't. Any problems just are gonna get magnified. So yeah, people go for couples therapy and stuff like that, and that works sometimes, but often it doesn't.
But it's interesting. It seems that you've structured your life in a way that, which is really amazing, that you get to do what you want. It doesn't seem like sacrifice is kind of a difficult word. What do you think about the word sacrifice? Is there any of it in your life?
Not really. I mean, I don't know what you mean. Like, should I stay home and take care of somebody who's sick? Yeah, if my wife got sick, I would stay home and take care of her and not be as active. But I won't go to a random stranger's house and take care of them because they're sick. Hopefully they have other people in their lives. Or if my children were sick, I would certainly sacrifice a lot to take care of them. People think, oh, if you have money, it's easy to talk about freedom. It's actually when I've been most broke that I've focused most on freedom, because that's when you have to kind of generate lots of ideas and try lots of things to get out of being broke. If you take a job and sit in a cubicle, you think you've traded this fear of being lost for some stability, but it's actually been much worse for you, because now you're more unstable than ever in a corporate cubicle job. So I've always tried to make sure that I've had as many opportunities as possible and that I've been as free as possible, even when I've been like dead broke and scared.
Right.
So I've never, I think I haven't worked a even when I've been, again, been dead broke many times in the middle, but I haven't worked like a regular job since 1996, just because I've been terrified of being, you know, handcuffed to one place.
Yeah. As you get older, what gets more and more important to you and what gets less important to you?
So I think when I was younger, preparing for a good life was really important to me. So I wanted to have a great career and make a lot of money, have great relationships, and it didn't really work out often. So I think now I'm more focused on preparing for a good death. So not that I'm going to die anytime soon, like I might not die for 10,000 years for all I know, but I want to make sure, you know, I leave some kind of legacy. And the legacy doesn't mean, I set up a charitable foundation or whatever. It means I'm good to my children, I'm good to my friends, I'm good to the people I work with, I'm good to my readers, and my readers get some value, and then they're good to their family and friends and colleagues and so on. I think kind of the strength of your ideas that you leave behind is your legacy. So I'm hoping there to do well. That's how I prepare for a good death. And also, how do you prepare for a good death? Well, I don't want to have a painful death. Yeah. So being physically healthy is important. And I think reducing stress is important. And sleeping, you know, as much as, you know, being healthy just in various ways is important. Anxiety causes, you know, all sorts of inflammation in the body. So trying to be as stress-free as possible helps prepare for a good death. So again, it's not as morbid as it sounds. It's not like I'm going to die tomorrow,
yeah.
But that's how I live well now, is by preparing for a good death.
Cool. So I do want to respect your time. You have another podcast in about 8 minutes, but I think we'll just end with a couple rapid fire questions.
Sure.
So when are you most proud of yourself?
Unfortunately, I don't think I ever am. So I think I'm always trying for the next thing.
Or most fulfilled. Or most.
Maybe that's a problem I have, is I'm always thinking about the next thing. And I think that's true for people in general. So I don't think I'm ever proud of myself.
Here's one thing. I remember seeing an interview with Conan O'Brien where he said a couple things. One, he said he gets famous off of something that should be treated, you know, comedy. And he said where he...
That's a really interesting comment,
yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
Because think about what is comedy? What is comedy as opposed to, let's say, the opposite of comedy is drama. So if criminals break in here right now and you pick up a machine gun and start firing at them, then that's like you're the hero and that's drama. If you pick up a gun and the gun backfires and you're kind of like going all over the place and you drop the gun and start screaming, that's comedy. So removing skills is comedy. So removing skills from some, so Conan's like interesting. Removing some important way of dealing with life, yeah. That's comedy. And so that's why he says it's something to be treated.
And I remember he says he went to a therapist and he's like, if this is going to affect my comedy at all, I'm not doing it. And it's this broader idea of not wanting to be, you know, 100% perfect or okay if it means some sort of artistic work or if other people get value out of it. Do you see a kind of value in, you know, your own kind of, and I can relate, kind of, you know, neurotic self sometimes that you don't want, you know, changed?
It's not that I don't want to change. I do want to change. I think Conan's wrong a little bit in that sense, although who's to say he's, yeah, Conan O'Brien. But, you know, Stephen Pressfield refers to this in the book called Turning Pro, where if you want to write a novel, don't live the life of a novel. Like, you need to have an extremely stable, calm life in order to write a novel, because you have to be writing for hours every day and sitting in a chair doing a boring act of typing into a keyboard. So, or you can have all sorts of drama in your life and live this up and down roller coaster drama, and you won't write your novel and you won't start your business. So I think you have to be treated in order to have that artistic success. But again, you know, Conan O'Brien has his way of doing it, which is very successful for him.
Speaking of a novel, what are some of the big things that you want to do that you haven't done yet? Do you want to write, you know, a classic literary novel, or there's some big creative projects that you want to do?
Yeah, definitely fiction is important, yeah, to me. But also, I want to see, you know, some of my latest investments that I'm helping out with. I'm torn between, you know, kind of the writing side and the business side. So I'm focused on both equally.
you mentioned in the Ferris podcast and in writing, you had a web design or web services company that you consulted with a lot of big gangster rappers in the 90s?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I started a company, and that and our main clients were like Bad Boy Records, Loud Records, which was the Wu-Tang Clan. We did a lot of stuff with Interscope, which was Death Row Records.
And you're a big rap fan even till today.
Yeah, yeah.
Who do you like today?
You know, it's funny. I definitely Eminem, Macklemore, Jay-Z, so kind of like the popular names, although Macklemore wasn't popular until just recently. But I kind of like old school stuff. Like, I really like, you know, people who I've had on my podcast, like Coolio, and, well, I like the Wu-Tang Clan. So I tend to listen to stuff I listened to 20 years ago.
Have you ever tried rapping yourself?
No, no. Although break dancing I did as a kid.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. In a past, you know, we had a music tech company, and when we used to make money, it was kind of hilarious, is teaching Quicken Loans how to freestyle rap. Uh-huh. It was me and a few Detroit rappers, and we got enormous...
So wait, you were a rapper in Detroit?
Yeah.
So did you hang out with Eminem at all?
I did not hang out with Eminem, unfortunately.
Do you know Paul Rosenberg?
I know of Paul Rosenberg. I've tried to get in contact. He saw my last company. He wasn't interested. they're not super active in Detroit or on the ground of Detroit. Uh-huh.
Although they are a little bit. Like, I like how... do you know Jude Angelini?
No, who's that?
He was a Detroit radio host. Now he's he was on the Jenny Jones show a lot, but he's from Detroit, writes about Detroit. Now he has he lives in LA, has a show on Sirius.
Sweet.
He wrote a book, which you would like, actually. It's his personal stories, but it has a Dennis Johnson flair to it. It's called Hyena, and it's hilarious. But I think Paul Rosenberg and Eminem helped him out a lot.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I mean, there are a few artists in Detroit, Travis Chandler, Dej Loaf, who, I mean, they're actively helping out. They just didn't like my company. but we love getting people who haven't rapped before to rap. And so if you ever have an interest in freestyle rapping,
to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm always interested in that stuff. But and rap is definitely a genre I still like. So I did the Source Magazine's website.
That's awesome.
So yeah, we had a lot of fun times. It was a long time ago.
Cool. This has been fantastic. Really appreciate your thoughts on startups, on investing, on relationships, on just kind of how you think about your life. And I appreciate you being so honest.
Oh, well, thanks a lot, Eric, for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of Product Hunt, actually. I probably surf it every day. What product should I look at? So
yeah, and on that note, I want to talk to you later about curating. We're having thought leaders curate lists of products they're really interested in and companies they want to promote. So
Love to help out.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thanks. Great talking to you.